So thank you, Rodney, and it gives me great pleasure to come here. This very strange situation for me, because this very place, St. Mark's Cathedral, was I used to come here a lot when I was a child. And at one time I was even going to become an Episcopalian priest, so I came here and asked the bishop. And little did I ever think I'd come here as a Buddhist monk. You know? So it's very ironic indeed. Life is its own kind of surprises. And so this it's good to see so many attending this evening, and this is an opportunity to reflect, to contemplate. What I say this evening is for consideration, and this is, you know, to see how it affects you. So it's just reflections from my own experience, sharing what I've learned over the years that I've been practicing meditation. And so the thing that attracted me to Buddhism years ago was the fact that it offered this opportunity to consider, contemplate the realities of existence and the questions of what is the meaning and purpose of life and how should I live it and what should I do with this life, because it did seem an incredible mystery that to be born as a human being, and various people were trying to convince me of various views they had. But no matter how reasonable or interesting or inspiring those reasons might be, you inevitably have to find out for yourself. So my endeavors in this direction have been, to find out this reality, the truth, myself. And so because my faith arose with Buddhism, and this was quite a surprise to me, because of course I was brought up as an Episcopalian, and I have very happy memories of it. It wasn't the kind of unpleasant experience that I had with Christianity, but I still had a very skeptical, inquiring kind of mind, and couldn't just believe because people said I should believe. So I've always had this rebellious streak in asking why should I believe that and what's the point. In the 1950s I came across, I was introduced to Zen Buddhism, and that struck a note in me which brought my attention to Buddhism in general. And then in 1963, I volunteered for the Peace Corps, and they sent me off to Malaysia, where I was teaching English for 2 years. And that brought me into the Southeast Asian area, of course, and into the world of Theravada Buddhism. So on a holiday to Thailand, I decided that when I finished my Peace Corps business that I'd return to Thailand and find out more about what they had to offer. So I did that, and then over the years I spent about 11 years in Thailand training with Ajahn Chah, who's now become very famous in the West. I'm sure most of you have heard of him or read, as many of his books have been translated into English. So this was a very wise teacher, and I was very fortunate in finding him, because at the time he wasn't one of the well-known meditation teachers in Thailand. He was probably known only in a remote part of Thailand that he lived in. But in Bangkok, where I spent 6 months, nobody had ever mentioned his name. And there were many other teachers mentioned, but never his. So I knew nothing about him. And then I met him by a seemingly sequence of coincidences. I found myself in his monastery, and from that time on, I never looked any further. I decided, this is good enough. This is where I'm supposed to be. Now, what attracted me to Ajahn Chah was he was a very good monk. He was, I knew I could get good training there. And, of course, in Thailand, it's a Buddhist country where 95% at least consider themselves Theravadan Buddhists. And there are thousands and thousands of monks. So there's a range of from the best to the worst in monastic practice, or lack of practice. So I was very fortunate to find so quickly the best. And so I've always been very grateful for that, because I thought it a great privilege to live with a wise human being, especially for such a span of time as 10 years. And these were very transformative period in my life, because up till then I was very confused, unhappy, not because of anything in particular. It's not that I consider my life an unfortunate one, or had terribly unfortunate experiences, but just the way I thought, because I was a skeptic and had developed a critical mind, then I tended to see faults in everything around me, including myself. And so the mind would get obsessed with these negative states, and I'd, you know, be caught in states of depression or just doubt and confusion. And the more I tried to reason it out, the more confused it all seemed. So I figured out I had to do something other than think. They had to get out of your thought process, otherwise, you know, there didn't seem any other way to do it. And I tried, you know, desperately to think positively about everything, because that's what in America was very popular at the time. The book called The Power of Positive Thinking. And so I tried that, but it was hard to keep it going. Especially if you have a mind like mine, it tends to be quite cynical and sarcastic. So just being good and positive kind of didn't seem to be very useful. But it was certainly being better than negative all the time. But the thing that attracted me was something in me awakened when I encountered Buddhism for the first time through reading D.T. Suzuki. I read a pocketbook edition of D.T. Suzuki's Zen Buddhism. And it seems to be like this ability to question and look into things, to use doubt, the way we think, and the way thinking leads to doubt, to use this for awareness, for developing a way that one can transcend or get beyond just the intellectual process or the habit patterns of one's thinking habits. So at first, when I started practicing meditation, because everything was new, and I started in Bangkok at a temple, Wat Maha Thot, which is a very famous, important, big temple in Bangkok. I started practicing there, and then I began to see the advantages of this, just sitting down for a while and watching my breath, and just calming down. In fact, on the third meditation lesson, it was the third day that I'd attended this monk who was teaching me, was giving me my third lesson, and I was sitting in a very quiet place in the monastery. I sat down, closed my eyes, and I heard a door slam. Somebody slammed the door. And the door slam the sound of the Dharamsala sent me into a state of utter bliss. And then I was, you know, suddenly I was in a state of just beautiful emptiness and bliss. And I thought, three lessons and I'm enlightened. I've got it. I thought it would at least take 10. So the next day I went back, sat down, nobody slammed the door this time, and I kept thinking about the previous day, and I kept thinking and thinking and waiting, and I drove myself into a total state of confusion and doubt and despair. So no, that mustn't, I kind of missed it again. But it did give me a kind of taste for the possibility, or what might actually be within my ability as a human being, that this is that kind of peacefulness, that stillness, is, you know, if you have a taste of it, you begin to see that maybe there's a way to be that way. And of course, I didn't know how to do it then. It was through those particular things that, maybe something like a door slamming just stopped the mind from thinking for a moment. And I was just in a state of rapture and bliss. But it had happened naturally. It wasn't like a sought-after state or a remembered state. But then, after that, I remembered this. And this is a problem that many of you probably have faced, is that you had very peaceful experiences and then you want them again, because that's how desire operates, isn't it? You remember something pleasant or beautiful or pleasurable, and it creates this desire, I'd like to have another. And so then you try. Where the actual initial bliss experience didn't come from a memory. I wasn't trying to get it. It just happened. It was spontaneous. I had no desire or no anticipation, no memory of having such a state before. But this also convinced me of the importance of meditation. So eventually I became a monk and spent the next 11 years living in Thailand, and most of that time with Ajahn Chah. And so I had these 10 years to really investigate the reality of the present moment. And the thing that the important kind of point the Buddha makes, the real essence of Buddha Dhamma, is that it's always about awareness. A natural state is not a created or a compounded state. It's not a concentrated state that we are, or you're fixed on anything in particular. It's a natural state to all of us, and yet we don't recognize it. We've forgotten it. And so we're looking for something, usually when we're meditating. And we would like to have some, if we read books about Buddha Dhamma, Buddha practice, Buddhist meditation, or about religion in general, there's, one develops images and perceptions of, say, what enlightenment is, or salvation, or liberation, or ultimate freedom, or ultimate reality, or whatever words, superlative words, convey something that we can't imagine, that we can't create an image of, but we have a sense for it. There's a kind of intuitive connection to this natural state of being. And yet the power of the world around us, the conditioning of the mind, the emotional habits, the identities we have with our bodies, with our memories, with our views and opinions, whatever, then this very attachment to these conditions, of course, are the obstructions to this reality. And so, you know, I found myself, even as a monk, creating another reality and creating myself into some kind of Buddhist monk, which obviously, you know, was, I certainly liked it better than when I wasn't a Buddhist monk, but I can't say it was liberating or enlightened. But because of the wisdom of the teacher, Ajahn Chah, and he would always stop me in midstream, like when getting caught up in my particular emotional take on a situation or my obsessive nature. And he had a very good way of kind of stopping me in the middle of it and getting me to look at what I'm doing, what I'm attached to. So many people have asked, you know, how I could learn from a teacher who couldn't speak English. And at the time, I couldn't speak the language, the Thai language. So for the first year, I had to learn the language. and I was motivated because I did want to understand what he was saying. And also, there was no one around that could speak English, so I mean, I didn't have a way out of it. The first month or so that I was with him, there were two Thai monks living at the monastery who could speak English quite well, so they helped. But after the first month, they disappeared. So there I was, having to learn everything new, like the living in that climate, the food, the culture, the monastic form. He was very strict with the discipline. So we had to learn how to conform to a discipline. And I spent the previous years before the Peace Corps as a kind of, this is pre-hippie America, but it was between the beatnik and the hippie period in Berkeley. I was a graduate student at Berkeley. And during that time, this sense of the American dream, you know, being able to do what you want, think what you want. The philosophy of that time was experience everything. And so I thought, that sounds really wonderful, you know. I was a pretty scared, frightened character by conditioning. So I thought, go out and just experience everything. So I tried that for a couple of years and ended up totally confused. So then going into a Northeast Thai monastery where they have all these rules, and it's very orthodox. It's not kind of New Age style at all. And the only thing you can do if you intend to stay there is conform to it. And I knew, something in me knew I had to learn how to do this, because that kind of impulsiveness and conceit, what I could see was an obstruction, you know. And so I deliberately chose this teacher because he offered this opportunity. I couldn't manipulate him. And where I could, oftentimes others, I couldn't, he wouldn't budge. So there was no other choice. I was going to stay there. I had to follow him. And this was not easy, of course, but I knew, something in me knew that this is what I needed to do. And so during that first year, I had to learn just to be patient and pay attention and conform, follow others, all kinds of skills that I'd never learned at the University of California. But also because of his kind of way of teaching, he wasn't a doctrinaire Buddhist. You know, he was obviously someone who knew what he was talking about. He wasn't an academic or a scholar, but he was a meditation. He taught meditation. He encouraged everybody to practice meditation. So even in this kind of remote part of Thailand, you know, he would teach the rice farmers how to meditate, just ordinary kind of people, even illiterate people, or he could teach anyone how to practice meditation. So it was going to be of help to them. It wasn't just some kind of idea of practicing meditation to get some kind of blissful state, but it was actually aimed at getting you to look inward at the way you looked at the world you created. So I, this afternoon, was having tea with some people, and they're asking about them. I had previously when I was at Ajahn Thanajan Riti's monastery, Wat Adam, it's in the metropolis of Woodinville, which I'd never heard of before, but now I know it. I mentioned somebody was asking, a Thai person was asking about the end of the world, and I was using the word Armageddon, and they picked up on this as I was using words, and he wondered, this gentleman was wondering what I was saying, what I was talking about. And this was a reflection that I found very valuable, because Ajahn Chah, you know, wasn't thinking of the world in the way that we think of the world. Like, at least the way I would think of the world from an American background would be, the world is something out there. You know, it's St. Mark's, it's Seattle, it's Washington State, it's the, we went to Mount Rainier, it's Pacific Ocean. It's all that out there. And then we think of the end of the world, they're using terms now in this country like Armageddon as a kind of end of the world, which is a rather terrifying concept. You know, the end of the world usually means extinction or annihilation. Or, in many way it's used now, it means that it's the end and all the sinners go to hell and all the chosen ones go to heaven. But the end of the world, in this sense, means it's something that's going to happen in the future. Ajahn Chah would always point to this present moment, and he would say, the end of the world is here. And he'd point to his heart. And he said, if you want to see the end of suffering and the end of the world, you look here. And he wasn't pointing to his own heart. He wasn't asking us to look at him. At least I don't think so. But the way I interpreted it is, I was supposed to look here at my own heart, and this fascinated me, because I could see how I didn't really know myself at all over the years. I was 32 at the time, 33 when I met Ajahn Chah. So I'd had 33 years generally of looking outward, seeking for answers, seeking for things in some external way, wanting answers to every question, solution to every problem, and really wanting other people to tell me, you know, like feeling I wasn't good enough, that I'm too hopeless or too stupid or inadequate, and that you probably know, or Ajahn Chah knows, or the Dalai Lama, he knows what I need, or, you know, so you're always looking outward to think, and you're kind of projecting onto various significant figures in your life as ones that know, and seeing yourself always in this term of being ignorant or confused or messed up. But then Numpa Cha was getting us to look at ourselves, you know. So when I would kind of project all my ideals onto him, you know, Ajahn Chah, you're the great teacher, you're the wise master, you know what I need. He'd never go along with that. And he'd always, kind of get me to turn away from projecting onto him anything by looking at myself. So he'd say things, well, you know, he said, who can know but you? You have to know. You're the only one that can know what's going on inside. You know what you're feeling, what you're experiencing at this moment. And so this confirmed something, a kind of an intuition that it had to, you know, even though I would prefer at that time to have him tell me. Because that would have made it much easier, you know. And I say, Ajahn Chah told me that I... because I didn't have a very, high image or great respect for myself. I saw myself always through faults, through critical attitudes. My weaknesses, my flaws were what I would dwell on. I would exaggerate. I'd get obsessed with the bit that isn't very good, with the weakness or the weak point or the flaw or the fault. And even if it was obviously a relatively minor flaw, I could make it into, it's like making a mountain out of a molehill. I was very good at that. You know, so you get obsessed, you know, you shouldn't think like this, you shouldn't be like that, and then the mind would start spinning and you just see yourself always in these very, at least I would, I can only speak for myself, in these very critical way. So by looking, by putting my attention here, then I began to see what I was doing. How I was caught in a thinking habit, in believing these negative thoughts, these critical thoughts. I actually believed them. I believe anything they said. And when I began to really observe this, and I realized that that which observes this isn't that way. That the awareness isn't a critical awareness. It doesn't have any criticisms to make about me. But this kind of inner tyrant, it was always having a go, you know, no matter, I realized that I could never satisfy this inner tyrant, because even when I was a winner and getting the prizes and the accolades, and people say what a great teacher you are, and the inner tyrant would say, it's not true. So, yeah, I realized that just by seeking praise in the world wouldn't be the answer. I could never get enough. And if I got it all the time, it still wouldn't be enough. It's just insatiable, because I'm stuck in this wretched habit of self-disparagement. And so living with Ajahn Chah, I had a good opportunity to observe this. Because in monastic life you have plenty of time. You have lots of nothing to do. And then in the Thai forest tradition, you know, there's no computers, no television, and nothing, you know, I hardly had any books to read. I had to learn to read Thai to satisfy my urge to read books. But I thought this was a very excellent opportunity, because I'm the kind of person that has to be driven into a corner. You know, if there's a way out, I take it, an easy way out. Though I think I did this quite deliberately, because I could have left. You know, there was nobody holding a gun to my head or forcing me to stay. But I really found this very helpful, because I began to, one thing Ajahn Chah did mention and encourage me was to see yourself in positive terms, to reflect on your own goodness. You know, to bring into consciousness the goodness of your life. Not as some kind of boasting of yourself, but an honest reflection and willingness to look and observe what's good in your life, in yourself. And when I did that, of course, I found it much easier to focus on what's wrong. I didn't find it easy to say very much about my goodness, because I'd never done that before. I never thought of myself in those terms. And yet, when I really considered this, I recognized that I love the good, beautiful, the true. You know, why am I a monk? Because I have evil intentions and want to, you know, why do I, you know, take precepts about not killing anything if I'm really bad? Because, you know, this lifestyle isn't all that helpful towards, you know, giving you the opportunities to be really bad. So this is like reflecting on life, you know, and seeing what is good, what is bad. What is the natural state of being? And this, of course, as you begin to develop insight and understanding of Dhamma, then you start recognizing. You have an experience where you actually recognize the natural state of being, of mindfulness. So mindfulness itself, the word mindfulness is an English translation of the Pali word sati. Sati and sampachanya is our ability to apperceive. It's an intuitive moment, to be able to take in the totality of this moment. It's not a thought moment. It's not a critical statement. It's non-judgmental, but it is discerning, it is aware. And this is such a natural state of being that when one is always trying to find something, or get something, or achieve something, or get rid of something, you miss out. You're always caught in these kind of habits of trying to get or trying to get rid of, trying to control, trying to manipulate. So in the kind of another irony of the life is, with its discipline and its strict boundaries for behavior, what it did was make life much more simple for me. It didn't give me so many alternatives or options in the moment. And so you're kind of forced, you know, like I was saying, being forced into a corner. What are you going to do if you can't run away from it? You've got to accept it, don't you? When there's no escape, what do you do when there's no escape? Is to accept this moment as it is. And so as I began to recognize this in myself, that this awareness is referred to as the gate or the door to the deathless. Now that always fascinated me, that why they use the word death, is they call it the amata dhamma, or amatapada in Pali. And amata is Pali for, translated as deathless. And with Buddhism sometimes people easily misunderstand it, because especially Theravada Buddhism, if it's just taken too rationally, too intellectually, it does sound like kind of annihilation. Its logic takes you to a sense of annihilation, of extinction of everything. And yet the Buddha made it very clear that that was not his intention. You know, in his first sermon that he gave after his enlightenment, he made it very clear to the five disciples that he was teaching or sharing this knowledge with, that it wasn't extinction or annihilation. So then what could it be? You know, but but the way the kind of Theravada style of the Pali scriptures are constructed is a way of reflecting in order to let go of death itself. Now this is an interesting one. Let go of death, because we think we're always trying to run away from it. You know, how many people are trying to, you know, even the word itself is not politically correct. to use it in public sometimes. And years ago, they wanted to publish a book called, I called it, Path to the Deathless. And the publishers didn't like the title because it had the word death. But I said, it's deathless. And they said, no, death is not a word that we can use on a title. But they actually ended up using it, they called Mindfulness, Path to the Deathless. That seemed to satisfy them. But what is it is when we talk about the amatatama, or ultimate reality, and this is like a metaphysical statement, isn't it? Ultimate reality, deathlessness, and then in Pali terms we have this sense of non-attachment, non-self, emptiness. So you have words like sunyata, anatta, nibbana, nirodha, cessation. These are the words they use, but they're all negations of their opposite, isn't it? So amata or deathless, mata is death, and in Pali grammar, giving you a grammar lesson tonight, A at the beginning usually means a negation, deathless. And then you reflect on the body. It's going to die, isn't it? So, and yet we're so strongly identified with it. And, you know, we're obsessed with what we look like, or, you know, with our age, or what we're wearing. And we're so, you know, when we have a passport, they always have a picture of your face on the passport. They never have a picture of your right foot. Always the face. Now my right foot, as you may have noticed, is my kind of mark of distinction. Everybody, in Thailand, I'm known as the Venerable Bigfoot. But yeah, I can't use that as for a passport photograph. I'm going to use the face. Identifying with the appearance, with the gender of the body. So we strongly identify with being male or female. Or with sexual orientation, we identify. Or with ethnic background or race. Identifying with nationality. With class or family. And these identities are always death-bound conditions. They're created. They're created by human ignorance. You know, so when we attach and identify and hold to these views, then we're limited by that. We're stuck with an identity that is inevitably unsatisfactory and going to fail us and cause us a lot of suffering. So when we begin to reflect on the way, on the conditions that we're experiencing, we're not trying to stop or get rid of them, but to recognize them, to be liberated from the power of these delusions of ourself as this limited form, these perceptions, these habits, these conditions, these thoughts, these memories. And so in Vipassana practice, which is investigating into Dhamma, looking at the way it is a real kind of determination to not to project anything onto the conditions by saying good, bad, right, wrong, but, or, you know, to rate some higher than others, but to see all conditioned phenomena is impermanent. So one of the major reflections that we have is in Pali, Sape Sankarani Cha, all conditions are impermanent. And so with Vipassana meditation, one is taking this concept of impermanence or anicca and then not trying to project it onto the body or the thoughts or habits we have, but to, it gives us a kind of new way of looking at what we've never considered in any other way. The changingness, how the concept, how you create your sense of yourself. How what you think you believe you are all the time. Don't you? You think, I'm this kind of person, I'm this way all the time. So even when I'm asleep, I'm this way, I have these faults. When I'm with my parents, I'm this way. When I'm with my best friend, I'm this way. And so I've got some, Ajahn Sumedho, they call me, Ajahn Sumedho. And then I realized, I don't spend much time thinking that I'm Ajahn Sumedho. You know, when people say Ajahn Sumedho, I know who they're, you know, they're talking to me. But it's not an obsession I have. I don't go around calling myself that. So sometimes this perception arises and I, you know, and then I think, but then I can assume I'm Ajahn Sumedho all the time. You know, so I have to be Ajahn Sumedho no matter who I'm with or where I'm at. This is like clinging to this perception. My mother didn't name me Ajahn Sumedho. This came later. So by reflecting in this way, you know, somebody says, you know, like I'm sleeping in my room and somebody says, where's Ajahn Sumedho? And he says, well, he's in his room, he's asleep. But then I think, no, when I'm asleep, it's no Ajahn Sumedho. Ajahn Sumedho arises because the conditions for that perception arise and then this perception arises. So by investigating the conditioned world in this way, and the conditioned world as we experience it, whatever way you are experiencing life, you know, it's not, you have to learn from the way we are. You can't learn how to be like me. You have to learn how to learn from yourself, the way you are, with both the virtues and the vices, the good side, the bad side, whatever. And in this way, then we begin to break through this illusion of ourself as this limited human creature, these memories, this kind of the illusion of a permanent kind of personality or soul that's uniquely me. This falls away because in the present moment, when there's non-attachment and there's emptiness, there's certainly awareness. There's consciousness, but I can't find any self in it. And so this is an intuitive moment where the mind, is at ease, is at rest. It's not asleep, fully alert, but knowing that there's no self is like this. By recognizing this, then I begin to see that to not be anybody is very peaceful. And that moment that I experienced when I sat for the third lesson of meditation at Wat Maha Thot in the door slam, that sense of a separate self has vanished. You know, it happened spontaneously and I didn't understand it with my conditioned mind. So it took a while to begin to recognize this very natural state that is with us, you know, never leaves us, is never absent, but we just forget about it, or we don't even know about it. And just examine your own life, how, you know, the illusions you create, the kind of impulses that you follow, the obsessions and that you identify with, the way you judge yourself or criticize yourself and the people around you. Now, living in a monastic community is very good practice because you have to live with a lot of people. We have monks and nuns living at a monastery in England, Amaravati. So I personally liked being alone. I thought when I became a monk I'd be a hermit. Because when I'm alone, The problems diminish considerably. And people, I realize I'm scared to death of people. And so I don't mind being alone, but people have always been a problem. And it's not really that, it's not because of the people involved, but because of the fear. And so in monastic life, I've had to learn how to live with a lot of people. And that's been quite a revelation for me, because when I was with Ajahn Chah, I was always trying to move away from that, trying to go off, become a hermit. And then he'd keep pulling me back in. And so, you know, but in the scriptures, the Buddha said, go off into the forest. I could quote scriptures, Ajahn Chah. It's in the book, and the Buddha said this. These are words of the Buddha, but he wouldn't, you know, he'd keep insisting I stay in the community. And then I realized this is where I was most weak and most frightened and most inadequate, was living with other people. And of course, in a monastery, you're living with, you know, you're living with basically very moral, very trustworthy people. But still, you can't stand some of them. So you begin to see how even though we've got the same aspiration, made the same strong commitment in the monastic life, the same, you know, moral standard and that, we're all kind of, so you respect that no matter what, whether you like them or not. But then the conflicts are around on the personal level. Now this is very interesting, because it was so easy to see people always as they shouldn't be the way they are. You know, you shouldn't act the way you do, and because it, you know, it's just offensive to us all. Sometimes we quote the whole community. We're very upset by the way you act. Really, it's me, you know, it's upset. And then you inevitably, when you're living with, because you agree to receive people who are willing to live in this way, you know, it's not a matter of whether I like them or not. It's just if they're willing to live like this, then accept them. So then you find yourself, you know, reacting. And so they describe Sangha life as one of these machines where you put all these kind of rough, coarse pebbles in, and then you switch it on. It has some kind of electric engine in it. And it keeps agitating this machine till all these rough, coarse, colorless, gray pebbles start shining. You see all kinds of beautiful colors. And that, like the shining of rocks that look pretty drab and ugly, and they come out quite beautiful. And that's how I see the Sangha life. And I said, you know, I only want certain kind of beautiful rocks. And certain pebbles, you know, they're already very pretty and please me. But you take, you know, even if they're really, you know, coarse and misshapen and whatever, if they're willing to live in this way, get into the polisher, then that's it. And it also, you begin to wear away the kind of rough, coarse edges that you don't even know you have. And so in living in community, I found it very, my weakness around community life was always thinking that somebody had to change for the better. You know, especially if I felt they didn't agree with me. So I I've got over this illusion because it doesn't work. And I've just begun to accept, you know, without conditions. And this was, and to do this, you have to let go and see your own conceit, you know, I know what you should be, or I don't like the way you are, you should change because you should be more like I am. You should agree with me. And then you see the absurdity of that. And so this, and we can see each one of us is working out our own karma in its unique way. And you never have two people the same. You know, there's certain common ground we share, but generally on the personal level, it's all about differences and habits and conditioning. Buddhists even trace it to past lives and all this. But whatever it is, our relationship to it is one of awareness, receptivity, understanding, allowing, rather than trying to pick and choose and make it something according to what we think it should be. You begin to see in your own experience of meditation, you know, once you learn to accept even the most unpleasant thoughts or emotions or the things you fear most about yourself, once there's this confidence in your awareness to receive it for what it is, then you can let it go. Then your relationship to it ceases naturally, not because you don't like it, but because you've accepted it unconditionally. You haven't tried to get rid of it because you don't like what it is. And so this we can only do through the development, cultivation of awareness, mindfulness. Now in the present time, you know, we can see the world around us here in the United States, the country with so many privileges and so much wealth and potential for everything. And yet, you know, the amount of happiness is rare. People live in you know, the word stress is constantly a word that you hear. And in Britain, for example, I don't remember, you know, years ago that word being all that common. When I lived in the States, you know, I don't remember people describing themselves as stressed. But now I hear this word a lot. Everywhere. Even in Bangkok, Thais are using it. Thais used to be noted for their kind of easygoing lifestyle. Now, you go to Bangkok and they say, oh, Kriyat Ma, Kriyat. Stressed out. And this is, you know, the result of don't take it personally, but the society itself, you know, our own cleverness, ingenuity, we're very clever and intelligent, so we can create all kinds of stress to experience. And this we do, you know, we do this a lot. And so many of us have this sense of, you know, can we just, you know, go off alone, leave the society, turn our back on the society and say, just let them stress out, I'm leaving you behind, goodbye, cruel world. Or is it, you know, is there, you know, we have to live with each other. The planet now is not big enough, you know, to find a place where you can live separately. You know, we have to learn how to share, how to receive, how to develop higher, you know, this wisdom that is our nature as human beings, but which we haven't developed. So we've developed our critical faculties. We're educated. A lot of information, a lot of knowing about a lot of things. People that have read and have mass media and, information at their fingertips. And so this, there's no shortage of this. But this all leads to a increasing of the critical mind. You know, it's this discriminative mind. This is better than that. This is good, that's bad. This is right, this is wrong. This is bigger, smaller, more beautiful, less, and so forth. So the critical mind is like that, and that's the thinking process. Its function is to discriminate. It's about, you know, the differences between the conditions. But when we're developing punya, or wisdom, this is not a discrimination. And so I use the word discerning. It discerns reality, but it is not a critical, it's not criticizing the conditions. It discerns conditions as conditions, knows the way they are, that they arise and cease, and that then the insights to not attach to these conditions, not identify, allow the conditions to be what they are, and they arise and cease according to other conditions, but allows us to discern, to recognize our true nature, which is the deathless, Nibbana, non-attachment. And that is, you have to recognize for yourself, you know, description, even the words I'm using are too limited. You know, that you can only, if you try to just think about it, you'll never get it, because you'll always be trying to, it'll always take you to some state of doubting and uncertainty and insecurity. So it's learning to trust yourself in awareness, learning to recognize and develop and trust this, because this is what is truly trustworthy. And this is something that is natural to you, every one of you. So it's not something you have to get that you're lacking, and that you have to get it, you know, and find it, and then you'll be fulfilled. It's recognizing it and cultivating this, what we call the path or the way of liberation. So I'll stop here. I've spoken for an hour, and then I think questions or can be asked if you have any. Yes. Yeah, well, that's quite normal. Well, I mean, it's not normal. It's natural to a human. But like emotionally, you're not conditioned emotionally for that. So when you start recognizing that, then your emotions really get frightened or resistant. And this is where, just be more patient with yourself, really. And trust yourself more, not what your emotions are saying, because your emotions will, you know, I can't. but be patient, you know, so you're not trying to suppress your emotions or deny them, but allow them to be conscious so you can let them go. So this is where patience is necessary. But I encourage you to trust that in yourself, that awareness. And no matter what your emotions say. And then you'll find that eventually these reactions, emotional reactions, will fade out, you know. And they have no, you're not reinforcing them anymore if you allow them to be what they are. And then as you know, then you begin to, as you experience this emptiness more and more, and you're not caught in the emotional reaction to it, then you can really reflect on it, because you know, then you can see, this is it, this is freedom, you know, not being a self, but being this awareness. And then, so it isn't like, you know, I'm unconscious, so I can't respond to situations, but it's where spontaneity comes from. It's where, you know, it's where we can respond to life in skillful ways. So it doesn't make us into kind of a zombie or a kind of unconscious nothing, which is sometimes the way you might think you're going. You're going to fall into a kind of blank state and be a cabbage the rest of your life. Or but this is important, you know, like this is, I see with so many Western people, because most of us come to Buddhism as adults, and we don't have the, like, a lot of faith in Buddhism. We're very questioning, skeptical usually, and very skeptical and critical of ourselves. So this, and so we tend to believe our critical thoughts, because they can seem very intelligent and rational and realistic. You see, and so I don't believe any of them anymore. They only know how to do that, and how to say the same thing. They can't be trusted. And it's not true what they say. So. Yes?
You spoke about Ajahn Chah's teachings of reflecting on our goodness, and I'm just curious about kind of hearing ongoing selfish thoughts and hearing the voice saying that I am a selfish person, kind of like what you were talking about, and knowing that that's not true, but they continue. And I'm just curious kind of what you would have to say to that.
Well, like being selfish is, you know, in our society, this is not good to be selfish. So, and so, you know, and altruistically, idealistically, we don't want to be selfish. But then sometimes we are, because it just happens. Sometimes you can't help but think me first, and what about me? And then the critical mind will say, oh, you shouldn't think like that. You know, that's selfishness, and you shouldn't. You're bad for thinking that way. You shouldn't be selfish. So then the critical mind, like the superego, or this force that we develop through language and through the development of critical thinking, then we turn it always, and it's always saying, you shouldn't be the way you are. That's why changing your attitude more, like when selfishness arises, just selfishness is like this. So I began to just know selfishness, and because you need to learn what it is. It's a condition, you know. It is what it is. But as soon as you think it's bad and I'm bad because I'm selfish, then you've made it more than what it is. You've attached to it, in other words, the concept, and so it keeps coming back. But if you trust yourself more, just to, when you know, even when your superego is saying you're really selfish, and you shouldn't be. Just listen. That's just something, a habit you developed. It's an empty, meaningless habit pattern. That's all it is. And put it in a context of, well, it is what it is, you know, but then, you know, don't no longer allow it to intimidate you or to get, you know, cause you doubt even, but it's like really receiving it, recognizing it, and it just naturally goes. And as you let go of these things, then you're actually breaking the habit. The habit starts fading out, losing its intensity, and will disappear. This is very important because I've been through this myself. The last thing I want to see myself as being is selfish. A selfish monk. Ajahn Sumedho, you know, he only thinks of himself, doesn't care about anyone else. And Theravada, we get accused of this a lot, you know. So, but anyway, it's not an identity, you know, altruistically. You know, I don't want to be selfish. And then you start, you know, and then selfish thoughts or what you assume are selfish thoughts or that come arise, and then this proves, you know. And then you have maybe developed a way of just trying to, but your intuition that you're not selfish, trust that more than this thing, because it really is untrustworthy. And as you see it in terms of what it really is, it'll drop away. Yes? In the back?
You said to accept what they are. It's easy to say, but very difficult to do.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely. Yeah, it's easy to say. But this is where, you know, it's learning to do it, really. Because it's going against maybe strong habits and habits of a lifetime. So that's where patience, being patient with yourself, and really, you know, just, you know, and being honest with yourself, not in a critical way, like, you know, this thing we sometimes consider being honest is believing our criticisms about ourselves. But one thing you can say about anything, like this moment, right now, at this time, from sitting here in this seat, the thing I can say about this moment is, it is what it is. Now, this is not a judgment about how it is. I'm not saying how it is or how I'm feeling it is. But it's a way of using language to point to this more mindful reality of receiving this moment in this broad spectrum. All that is a part of this moment. All of you in this place, the way it is now. You know, so it's not looking for any quality or any condition, or any making any value judgment. But you can honestly say, this moment, when I say it is what it is, I'm not, it's not just pushing it aside, but it's a kind of opening. It puts me in a state of receiving this moment. And then it's like, then it's from this point, I get perspective on the particular conditions that might arise in consciousness. And so when we, develop this right attitude or this attitude, then this this gives us the insight into how to deal with the particular problems we might have personally. So, you know, like just living, you know, being, say I used to find in the monastery, you know, because I tended to be very idealistic and see myself as, you know, trying to live up to a high standard of what a Buddhist monk should be. And sometimes I was shocked at some of the kind of reactions I'd have to particular in situations. So one time, I remember, I was this was in Thailand, and the monk that sat next to me was, you know, a very shy and kind of frightened monk, and he had very bad complexion, and obviously had very low self-esteem, and nobody paid him much attention, but because I sat next to him, he was, you know, he was senior to me, and I sat next to him, I kind of developed a friendship with him. And I quite liked him personally, you know, so it was, you know, because, but then I did recognize, you know, he was, you know, he was so easy to ignore or to pass by, and there's something about him that he tended to create this reaction in others. So one morning I was standing outside the temple and he comes, I was talking to some other monks, and he comes up to join us. And he's standing in a very peculiar way in front of me. And I have this big impulse, overwhelming impulse, to kick him. Which I didn't do. I didn't do it. But it shocked me, you know, shocked me that I would have such an impulse, because my self-image is one that I would never kick anybody. And especially him. And he's the one monk in the old monastery I would never want to kick, you know, as an ideal. But because and I realized it was his body language. He was kind of cowering in front of me, like bent over and cowering, like he was waiting for me to hit him or kick him. And then it's like, this is kind of almost like body language. It sends off these signals. I suddenly realized how it does, the way we walk, the way we move has an effect on our consciousness. And I never noticed that before, because the impulse was so surprising to me, but then I reflect on it. It was because I could, also, like, we used to have a dog in one of the monasteries that would, it was a very clever dog, and it liked to go with us on the alms rounds. So we have to go on these long, this was a remote monastery, we'd have to get up early and walk for hours barefoot into these various villages to collect food. And this dog would go with us. And this dog was a very clever dog, so it would hop along, you know, run along behind us, its tail up in the air, and seeming to just enjoy himself totally. As soon as we'd enter the village, the other dogs would come out and growl. The tail would go down between his legs, he'd cower, and he'd walk cowering out through the village, while the dogs followed, and as soon as we got out of the village, the tail would go up, and he'd be like, he was streetwise, in other words. And I thought, this monk is cowering like that, you know, like, I mean, he wasn't intending, but it was a habit. And so, just the way we, you know, the way, being American also, when I first went to live in the Thai monastery, American men walk in a very aggressive way. And in Thailand, men don't walk like that. And as monks, you train yourself not to look aggressive at all. You know, the whole monastic form, the body language of a Buddhist monk is non-aggressive. So, but I didn't know that, and so I was just walking, I'd walk up to a monk, you know, like an American guy, and he'd start backing away like I was going to attack him. I do, you know? Then realize how, you know, how sensitive this realm is. It's a, you know, this is the experience of total sensitivity from birth to death of your body. And we pick up messages from all kinds of places, you know, that we become, you know, we become creatures of habit and conditioned into various ways of thinking and perceiving. And then mindfulness is the only way we can get out of those, that limitation, that conditioned process. And both, you know, in terms of the physical identity with the body, with the emotional habits, with the memories, thoughts, views, opinions. Yes?
You mentioned that you were partially drawn to Buddhism in your attempt to answer the question of what is the meaning of life. After all these years, have you discovered the answer? Or is the question misguided?
Yeah, it's the wrong question. But it is a question that we, that gets us, you know, that can motivate us. And because, you know, what you're learning, because you're looking for a meaning, is some kind of external definition or something within the realm of thought and ideas. And it's not. The thing you discover, the thing you realize through awareness is liberation. Liberation is like this. Freedom is like this. Deathlessness is like this. And so then, when you're thinking, what is the purpose of life, then it's hard to describe and make anything, you know, to, and they have various, because whatever you say, you tend to attach to. This is where Buddha Dhamma so skillfully presented, because you don't start from the top. Like theistic religions always starts from the metaphysical top. So you say, I believe in God, and then and where the Buddha used, there is suffering. So rather than a metaphysical truth, he pointed to an existential truth, which is common truth. You know, it's we all have it, you know. So whether you're rich or poor, male or female, Asian or European or whatever, suffering is like this. You know, so, you know, even the most fortunate human beings as well as the most wretched. And then the thing in countries like this where we can't blame our suffering on, like, on poverty or, you know, certain people can, but so much of our, I mean, from my own experience has been quite, you know, I've been given a lot of things, options, opportunities, and comfort and good conditions. So the suffering became very apparent to me was something in me created, that I created. Where when you're talking to people that are poor, they still hope that getting rich will solve all their problems. Or some of them, anyway. But I have no illusions about that. You know, even if I became the richest man in the whole world, and I didn't know this, I'd still probably be a very miserable person at this time. But it is like the Buddha is pointing to reality. So it's like, so the word Buddha itself means awakened. It really means this awakened state, conscious, like you're conscious. And then awakening, rather than just operating from the conditions, the conditioned perceptions that you've acquired. Now those conditions, perceptions, we tend to interpret conscious experience through conditioning. It's based on ignorance. So that's where we create ourselves, I'm this kind of person, and I should or shouldn't be, and the whole sense of me and mine come forth, because this is how we're conditioned by the cultural conditioning, social conditioning. And all this comes out of human ignorance. It's not out of wisdom. And some of the conditioning is good, some of it is terrible, but it is conditioning. And so as you awaken to the conditioning, doesn't mean you get rid of it, but you no longer believe in it. You no longer limit yourself by attaching to it. And so you're liberating, even within the limitations of a human form, and getting, you know, as you get old and the life impinges on you, lose your loved ones, and you get diseased and have pain and all this. These are all bearable if we know this reality. But if it's just coming from personal reactions, then if we lose our money, lose our health, lose our friends, then we lose ourselves. We hate ourselves, or we feel sorry for ourselves, or we kill ourselves, or whatever, because the suffering is too much to bear. But because of the way we identify and feel this sense of loss. But in awareness, then loss is recognized, and we find our refuge not in trying to hold on, but through liberating ourselves from attachment and letting our life flow accordingly to its karma, to its nature. So then you, whatever, say, from my perspective, whatever I have to experience from now until the death of this body, I'm quite willing to learn from that. You know, it's whatever that might be. You know, success, failure, praise, blame, good health, bad health, or whatever. Because I really trust in this awareness. And then I put it to a test. You know, for many years I've tested it out in according to situations that happen. And so I trust it, because it is a refuge, you know, it is a real refuge. Refuge is a safe place. And the only possibility of a safe place at this moment is through the awareness, not through attaching to anything. And this then you prove to yourself. You can do it. You can put it to the test and find out. Yes?
The monastic order is real intriguing to me in terms of being able to follow the five precepts. The difficulty I have is living in the world that we live in, where our media celebrates killing and lying and self-hate and self-press, continually bombarded with them. And it's kind of hard to stay at peace when you follow that kind of tradition or you're involved in that tradition. So, do you have any suggestions?
Well, this is where it's very important for you to recognize this natural state of awareness, so that then the world that you experience, you can have some perspective on. You know, you can have more compassion for it and not be so kind of intimidated by it. I mean, one thing is to recognize the world is the way it is, and that ignorance does mean that what goes on around us can be quite appalling. You know, and that doesn't mean we approve or don't care, but we have a much better way of responding to the society we're in if we're aware within ourselves. And then I remember when I was at Berkeley, before I was a monk, you know, I used to complain about the state of the United States then. This is back 1960. And, I think, well, you know, what they do and all the mistakes they're making. And then you get together with your friends and you rip apart, criticize everything. And And I was in the, I was studying in the, in the, in on Indian civilization. So I was very interested in Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. So I remember thinking to myself, why can't the United States produce somebody like Gandhi? Why do we always produce such mediocrity for our leaders? You know, why can't we produce somebody saintly and good, brilliant, and like Mahatma Gandhi? And then inner voice said, well, why don't you try? And so that, no, not me, I can't do it. Because, you know, I would, you know, I wanted the President of the United States to do it, or somebody else. But then I realized what I was doing, you know, that if I didn't put forth the effort, how can I criticize anyone else? At least I can, you know, at least I can make that effort. And so that gave me a, even though I, you know, but it did bring up this sense of, I can't never be like Gandhi or things like that. But these are just personal reactions. But I trust in is that this is a way to really help the society we're living in. What we can actually do right now, it's for the benefit of everybody, every creature, is awareness. And then through other possibilities, we might be able to help in some other way, you know, by in political situations or economic or social ways, whatever. But this is like getting, what can I do right now for the benefit of all sentient beings? You know, just to take that kind of altruistic perception and then apply it to this moment, and then I recognize that if I don't create myself out of ignorance and illusion, that connects me to all sentient beings on this level of consciousness, you know, and not me as a person, but it's like the separation and the seeming separation and division that we have through the senses is no longer the dominant perception in consciousness. So then, more and more, one begins to see that the more of us that recognize this, the more possibility that things can change for the better in terms of the society we're living in. Anyway, this is what my take on it. But it, like here in America, you do have, you know, in spite of the things that one can criticize, that, you know, we can have meetings like this, and there is, you know, a quite a strong force of interest in meditation and in spiritual development that didn't exist 40 years ago when I lived here. It was just not, you know, I didn't know anybody. I could imagine being at St. Mark's talking about Buddhism. Yes?
I've got a last question for you.
Oh. Okay, yes? Was.
I didn't understand when you say death.
Yeah, well, like this death is what we, is a word that we use that means the end of something, right? Like when we use the word death, it usually means physically, like the death, the end of the physical body when the breathing stops and the consciousness leaves it and no longer conscious and breathing, and that's death of the body. But then in meditation we're also looking at the way things end in our minds, so you can see, like, thoughts arise and cease, emotions arise and cease, So instead of applying the word death to it, we say cessation. What begins ends, the ending of a feeling, end of an emotion, end of a thought. And so by recognizing this, all conditions are impermanent. They arise and cease. That means all conditions are death-bound. Anything that arises, anything that is born, ceases or dies. And our identity, out of the conditioning of the mind, is always with the conditioned realm. You know, I'm the body, I'm this person. These are conditions. So in realizing the deathless, by letting go of these illusions we create, then we recognize the deathless reality. And that is beyond words. I mean, because it's reality, and words always can be misleading, because this is what we mean, enlightenment or intuitive realization. You know, it's the true nature of being. It's not a personal identity or perception anymore, but a recognition and a realization of truth, of ultimate truth. And when you recognize this, then there's nothing to fear anymore, because why we're frightened is because we're afraid of death, usually. We're afraid of dying, we're afraid of pain, we're afraid of losing things, of loss, of humiliation. There's so much fear in the society, because it's a society that creates this fear, you know, and a sense of loss, and we're going to lose, and we're going to die, and we're going to everything's going to, we'll get sick, and we don't know what's going to happen. But if you develop this awareness and the insight into the Dhamma, then you have the realization of deathlessness, and the fear problem dissolves. Because fear comes through identity, through the conditioned realm. So I think it's time for me to stop, for you to stop. Thank you very much.